change. What a day.
Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of the major economic events and trends of our time. Jobs, incomes, debts, prices, you name it. The economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities. I teach currently at the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write regular economic analysis for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis for The Guardian, the newspaper in Great Britain, and several others. If you're interested in the kinds of work we do, the analysis we offer, the insights we try to develop, please know that you can get much more of the same from either of our two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Both of them are free, available to you at your leisure, and full of information that we add to every single day. Both of those websites are also equipped to allow you to communicate directly with us. Send us your comments, criticisms, questions, suggestions. We read them all, use them to shape our program, and select a very few to respond to on the air. Please understand we cannot respond to all of them. They're simply too many, which is terribly gratifying to us, but does limit our capacity to respond. So once again, either of the two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. And we also ask you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. This is Thanksgiving time, so let me try to participate in the spirit, if I can say that, but a little bit with tongue in cheek. Recently, there were two events that are so opposite to the spirit of Thanksgiving that I simply had to comment on them. One of them has to do with a state representative in Hawaii from Honolulu by the name of Representative Tom Brower. He has become famous, if that's the right word, stories about him in the Honolulu Star Advertiser newspaper and elsewhere, because of the following. He has taken to walking through the city with a sledgehammer, coming upon homeless people wheeling their belongings in a cart. He removes their belongings from the cart and either returns it to whoever seems to be to him the rightful owner of the cart, or, and this happens often, he smashes the cart to bits with his sledgehammer. When asked the question, aren't you afraid you might have a problem with some of these homeless people whose carts you are removing or destroying? Here was the answer that he gave to the Star Advertiser of Honolulu, quote, when you are walking down the sidewalk with a sledgehammer, people get out of your way. Representative Tom Brower using a sledgehammer at Thanksgiving time. It is remarkable, beyond the obvious, that a person can see a problem growing in our society, like homelessness, and decide that the way to cope with that problem is to destroy one of the few things a homeless person has, which is a vehicle to carry around the few belongings they can afford to keep with them when they are without a home. What a way to solve a social problem. Will the person who's homeless be better off without a cart? You think we will all be better off if that person has no cart? Think a minute. But again, thinking would lead you to wonder about the causes of the situation rather than blaming the victim and smashing his cart. Likewise, the opposite of Thanksgiving occurred over the last couple weeks in, yet again, the Walmart Corporation. What's it this time? It turns out that Walmart in the Cleveland, Ohio area, and perhaps many others we don't really know, has taken up setting out bins in the employee area asking employees to contribute food items to the bins to help out other Walmart employees who can't otherwise enjoy a Thanksgiving dinner. Now, here again, notice, as with Tom Brower in Honolulu, in Cleveland and in who knows how many other Walmarts, a problem is recognized. There are workers at Walmart, people with full-time jobs working, who can't have enough income to enjoy a Thanksgiving meal with their families. That's the problem, and the Walmart folks see it, just like the rest of us do, since the statistics about people without enough money to pay for the food they need shows that there are 70 or more million Americans in that situation. But what does Walmart do to solve or help this problem? Since Walmart is among the corporations with the largest numbers of employees earning at or barely above the minimum wage, which, by the way, gets you a poverty-level income, since Walmart is in that position, the obvious solution for its employees to be able to afford Thanksgiving is to pay them better than you do. Be proud enough not to be at the bottom of the pay chain, but be somewhere that's decent and minimal, and that would allow your workers not to rely on cans of beans from other workers. Why don't you pay them? The Walmart family that exists now is among the richest Americans in the country, assets in the billions, but their employees don't have enough for Thanksgiving. They see the problem. They fail to see the solution. They come up with something that only makes it worse. Other Walmart employees, also paid poorly, are going to give a little of what they can afford to help the others who are in worse shape than they are. Shame on Walmart. Shame on Tom Brower. What a country. Our next economic update has to do with a listing I found extraordinary and I wanted to share with you. The listing of the 10 major companies in America paying huge numbers of employees the least. We might call this the opposite of a prize, or maybe we've called it a booby prize. Who knows? Companies that pay the least. The source for this is the website 24/7 Wall Street, and the information was gathered by another website that you can visit to verify these numbers if you're interested. This website is called Glassdoor.com. One word, Glassdoor.com. So visit 24/7 Wall Street or Glassdoor.com, and here's what you will learn. I'm going to go from 10 to number 1. 10th. On their list of companies paying the least, Starbucks, the coffee company. That's right. They have 120,000 workforce here in the United States. The CEO last year, $29 million. Wow. Number of stores in the United States, something on the order of 13,500. Their average baristas at Starbucks are paid less than $9 an hour. Number 2, TJ Maxx, a discount clothing store that operates TJ Maxx, Marshalls, and Home Goods. They're in the neighborhood of an average of less than $8 an hour. I won't give you all the other statistics because I want to give you the names of the companies. Macy's, U.S. workforce, 175,000, under $9 an hour. Darden Restaurants. They run the chains Olive Garden, Red Lobster, and so on. They are listed in the sources I cited to you as paying less than $10 an hour. They have 2,000 stores, a workforce of over 200,000. Sears Holding, the owner of both Sears and Kmart, they have 246,000 employees. They're in the neighborhood of less than $8 an hour, according to their hourly wages. At least many of their workers have that. Over 2,000 stores. Number 5, Yum Brands. They run KFC, Pizza Hut, Taco Bell. They have 18,000 stores, almost 700,000 workers, often paying people less than $8 an hour. Kroger, the supermarket, Target, McDonald's, and then the number one, Walmart. That's right, Walmart, almost 5,000 stores, almost 1.5 million Americans work there. Hourly wages for sales associates are less than $9 an hour, according to Glassdoor.com, etc., etc. It's Thanksgiving time, and so let's give them the thanks that they deserve. Making an economy full of millions of Americans trying to live at that level, while the people who run and serve that corporation and own its shares have more money than they ever dreamed. I want also, because I've been doing it, to bring to you information about a remarkable change, at least so far. There is a new pope for the Roman Catholic community, Pope Francis, and he has developed, among other things, a cabinet of 8 cardinals that are close to him, that help him, and that the coordinator of that, at least publicly known as the coordinator of his advisories, is a cardinal from Honduras, cardinal by the name of Oscar Rodriguez Maradiaga, who comes from Tegucigalpa, my apologies if I'm mispronouncing it, in Honduras. And he recently gave speeches, both in Dallas and elsewhere, Dallas, Texas, and elsewhere, and is quoted for having made the following statement, which I find as an economist remarkable to hear from a leading church prelate, someone as close to the new pope as Cardinal Maradiaga is. So I wanted to share it with you. I am now going to quote. The globalization of the exchange of services, capital, and patents has led over the past 10 years to establish a world dictatorship of finance capital. The small transcontinental oligarchies that hold the financial capital dominate the planet. The lords of financial capital wield over billions of human beings a power of life and death. Through their investment strategies, their stock market speculations, their alliances, they decide day to day who has the right to live on this planet and who is doomed to die. Those are the words of Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez Maradiaga of Tegucigalpa, Honduras. His topic, the state of the church through the lens of the new evangelization, speaking to the University of Dallas Ministry Conference in Irving. Remarkable, remarkable words and thoughts from leaders of the Roman Catholic Church. My next update has to do with the Nobel Prize. I have been criticized, and I want to thank the listeners who have told me this, for loosely using this term Nobel Prize to speak of the award giving to economists every year since 1969. I have done the research, and my critics were correct. I was wrong. It really shouldn't be called the Nobel Prize. It was not set up by Alfred Nobel back a century ago, the way the other Nobel Prize, properly so called, were. It was added much more recently and is really a prize given by the Swedish National Bank every year to economists that it chooses together with the Nobel Committee. But I should have made that clear, and I should have also used that as a moment to comment on this prize. It is stunningly unfair and biased. There really is no polite way to say otherwise. It has given the overwhelming bulk of its prizes to people who celebrate, support, and endorse capitalism, acting as though the economics profession had a universal, unanimous view about capitalism as the economic system to pursue. That has never been true. It isn't true today, but you wouldn't know it from the prizes of the National Bank of Sweden, erroneously called by me as well Nobel Prizes. They have given their prize on occasion to extraordinarily right-wing economists. Friedrich Hayek is one. Milton Friedman was another. They have never given the prize to anyone for whom the economics of Marx or Marxism played a role, even though those economists number millions across the world in societies that follow those ways of thinking, at least in part, in what they do. It's extraordinary. For me personally, I have an experience with it, since I was privileged to know the woman economist who was clearly the most important woman economist of the 20th century, and as well one of the top 10 economists of either gender in the 20th century. Her name was Joan Robinson, and for most of her adult life, she was a professor of economics at Cambridge University in England. She worked closely with people like Maurice Dobb, John Maynard Keynes, and many others. She wrote prolifically across the spectrum of economics, neoclassical, Keynesian, Marxian. She was unusually adept in multiple approaches, a famous writer, prolific producer of analysis, original. No excuse that the committee overlooked her. Astonishing bias, pretending to be a prize for the best. It's actually a prize for the best so long as you toe the line. Let me finally mention a couple of shorter economic updates, take a little extra time because I think they're so important. There are 12 million Americans who make what are called payday loans. These are people who live so close to the edge that in order to be able to put food on the table in the days remaining before they get their next check, whether that check is weekly or bi-monthly or monthly, that they have to go to the bank or to a lender, usually these are corner storefront type lenders, and get what's called a payday loan, a loan for a short period of time where you pledge your paycheck to pay back. So you're simply tiding yourself over till your next paycheck. 12 million Americans need to do this. And the problem is that these lenders rip these folks off with interest rates that work out to as high as 400% per year. You heard me right. 400% per year. Punishing these people with penalties, making them give access to the lender to the bank account so that the money that the lender demands can be withdrawn from the borrower's bank account even without their knowing about it, etc. So bad are these payday loans, so discriminatory, so hurtful and costly to people who obviously can afford them the least, that 15 states in the United States, 15 out of 50, have outlawed payday loans. But the other 35 haven't. And the big banks, who are often the lenders providing the money to the payday loan folks, are all earning such enormous income, ripping off the poorest and the most squeezed amongst us, that they're blocking those other 35 states. It is a scandal of the United States, and somehow Thanksgiving is a good time to shine the long-needed light on that kind of a situation. Lastly, we are this month celebrating an unusual day. It's called World Toilet Day. That's right, toilet, designated by the United Nations, UNICEF. And here's what it's about. It brings to our attention that 2.5 billion people on this planet that we all share do not have toilets to use. They are roughly 36% of our people on this earth who don't have the minimum of what we call sanitation. And the UN wants to shine the light on that reality. It wants to point out that diarrhea, which kills millions of children every year, worms that infect and destroy the lives of many people, these are diseases that come from inadequate sanitation and can be virtually eradicated if you give everybody a proper private toilet. They talk also in ways I really can't read about the particular risk to women who face sexual attack when they can't have a proper place for their toilet activities, to be blunt about it. All I can say, besides endorsing the UN call for this problem to be addressed, all I can say is we live in an economic system, capitalism, which I talk about all the time, as you know, which wants us to support it as the best economic system, Really? An economic system that dominates the world and condemns more than a third of the people to not only not be rich like a tiny number are, not only not be quote-unquote middle class, shrinking as though that number is, but they can't even be working class. They can't even be the working poor. These are people who have no pot to do you know what in and are suffering illnesses, attacks. What kind of an economic system works that way on Thanksgiving yet? Let me turn then to the first of our more substantive discussions. And here I am happy to acknowledge I'm responding to many of your emails and comments to me wanting me to talk about this issue. And this has to do with the economics of organized religion. And here's what the questions have been to me, mostly about. What exactly is the tax situation of organized religion, of churches, synagogues, mosques, and so on? And how does it affect the larger society we live in? I'm going to here talk about the United States, but this kind of situation exists more or less in this way in many countries. Not all, but many. So first, using the United States, let's be real clear on what we are talking about. Churches, mosques, synagogues are given a tax exemption in the United States. What does that mean? It means that the property these institutions sit on, the land, the buildings, the vehicles they own, the property they possess, is not subject to property tax in the communities where these institutions are located. So, for example, if you live in City X, then you are a citizen of a community that delivers all the usual public services to churches, synagogues, and mosques. It cleans the streets around them. It provides them with fire protection and police protection. It cleans the air from pollutants. It educates the children in public schools, the children of priests or rabbis or ministers, whatever. All public services of a community are provided to its religious institutions, but the religious institutions are not taxed to pay for those services, which means everybody else pays. It means you pay if you're a business or if you're an individual who owns a home or a store. You pay taxes not only to provide public services to you, but also to provide public services to others who do not pay taxes. And churches, synagogues, and mosques are among them. Not only do they not pay property taxes, but churches, synagogues, and mosques do not pay income taxes on the money they earn. They do not pay sales taxes for the products they buy. In other words, churches, mosques, and synagogues are exempted from all taxes, meaning that the rest of us must pay more to provide them with the local services, the state services, and the federal services that they demand and that they get without having to pay for them. This has some interesting implications I thought you would want to know about. First, people who are not believers in any organized religion, who do not believe what they believe, or else believe it but do not make use of those institutions, do not attend them, do not carry out family celebrations in them, etc., are nonetheless required to pay for them. This raises remarkable questions in a society that says it believes in the separation of the church and the state. If they were separated, then either they shouldn't be getting the services, or they should at least pay for them the way everybody else does. It also raises the question, what would be the interest in organized religion? What would be the support of organized religion if it had to pay its own way, if it wasn't subsidized? If a church didn't receive free public services, if it had to pay for its garbage collection, if it had to pay for the quality of the air and the quality of the water it gets, if it had to pay for police and fire protection, by the way many businesses are required to do, then of course it would have to charge its parishioners the money to pay for these services. And it's a very interesting question of what attendance and interest in organized religion might be if the people who participate had to pay for what they're participating in. Then there were other questions. When a church sits on a piece of land that becomes more and more valuable because the city is prosperous, because more people move to the city. In other words, if the church becomes the owner of more and more valuable land, independent of anything the church itself does to the land or to the buildings on the land, who gets the benefit of that rising value? Does the larger society, whose growth and prosperity accounts for the rising value, or does the church itself get the benefit of the rising value of its land and buildings? And since that rising value is called, properly speaking, a capital gain for the church, is it required to pay any tax on the rising value of its property, the way a person is who has a rising value of stocks or a rising value of paintings or a rising value of anything else? And the answer is, of course, that churches are exempt from that. So, yes, I think the question of the church's exemption from taxation is a proper topic for discussion, even though the power of the religious establishment in the United States is such that you will very, very rarely hear any word about this, which is one of the reasons why I thought it was an appropriate topic for our program. It is the power of organized religion to keep its subsidization by the government through the tax system off the table of discussion. And it is very interesting that those folks who in this country declaim the loudest against government handouts seem to forget that one of the greatest beneficiaries of a government handout in our society is organized religion. To the churches and synagogues and mosques of this country, endless federal, state, and local public services are delivered, saving them billions of dollars a year in expenses to pay for these basic services. And they pay no taxes whatsoever for these services. All the rest of the population pays the taxes that have to cover the delivery of services to organized religion. They are the receivers of government handouts, and the delivery of free services to churches, mosques, and synagogues is one reason why the rest of us pay the taxes we do. Something it might be worthwhile keeping in mind the next time you hear a conversation about taxes and those dependent on taxes, conversations which in our culture tend to leave out the religious community, and there's no economic rationale for doing that. Let's take our mid-program break, folks. I'll be back with you in a short amount of time. This is Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff. Stay with me. I will be back shortly.
I wanna be a bottle blonde. I don't know why, but I feel calm. I wanna be an idle teen. I wish I hadn't been so clean. I wanna stay inside all day. I want the world to go away. I want blood, guts, and chocolate cake. I wanna be a real thing. Yeah, I'll be shopping, I'll be shopping at teen idol. Be shopping at prom queen, fighting for the title. Instead of being 16, I'm burning up the Bible. Feeling super, super, super suicidal. The wasted years, the wasted youth. The pretty lies, the ugly truth. The day I wanna be a virgin pure, a 21st century whore. I want back my virginity, so I can feel infinity. I wanna drink until I ache. I wanna make a big mistake. I want blood, guts, an angel cake. I'm gonna puke it anyway. Yeah, I'm shoving, I'm shoving a TT.
Okay, folks, welcome back. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to remind you again that we have the two websites where you can go and follow any of these topics and these discussions if this kind of analysis interests you. rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. And likewise, please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Continuing our major discussions of major topics, typically topics that your communications to us through those websites has put on our agenda, I wanted to deal with an issue that comes up often in your minds as shown to us by your emails. This has to do with what apparently strikes some of you as a conflict or a contradiction or a problem. It goes something like this. Some people believe that what we ought to be doing is providing people who are unemployed with jobs. And I'm among them. That is, we look at a society that has 20 million people without work, that has one-fifth of its tools, equipment, and raw materials sitting idle, gathering rust and dust. And folks like me say, my goodness, the people want to work. The tools, equipment, and raw materials for them to work with and on are available. And if we got these two things together, which everybody wants, we could have way more output, wealth, in short, that would allow us to solve our problems of poverty, our problems of homelessness, our problems of helping poor people around the world, all the rest of it. So what kind of economic system is it that doesn't put the people who want to work, together with the tools and equipment and raw materials, to produce the social welfare that we could have? So that's one kind of argument. But here's the other one that is sometimes seen as standing in conflict. People who are ecologically minded, environmentally sensitive, or people who just have a different idea say, why are we all working ourselves to death? We shouldn't be working because we're using up the natural resources in a way that's unsustainable. Or we're spending time accumulating goods that don't make us better off or happy. We would be better off with more leisure, with more time for the relationships of life that really matter. And we tend to see an argument between those who are concerned of putting people to work and those who are concerned to say, wait a minute, we're working more than we ought to for ecological or self-sustaining reasons. And I think it's important to understand that these two interests are not at all in conflict. That's an important point to get clear and so I want to spend a little time with you on it. First, there is every reason to say that everybody who wants to work, who wants to have a job to go to during the day, who wants to have the sense of social importance that comes from performing a useful job, that has a useful output, a job that allows you to contribute back into the economy in exchange for all the fruits of other people's labor that you get in the form of your food, your clothing, your shelter, and so on. People want to work because it gives them a sense of being an upstanding part of the community, not being dependent on other people in a one-sided way, etc. We ought to honor the desire of people to be part of the working community. I don't see any problem in it whatsoever. And now let's get to the supposed conflict. There is no contradiction or problem in giving everybody who wants a job, and at the same time letting the society decide whether its commitment to the natural environment means we want to do less production, whether its commitment to having more leisure, more time to relate to your friends, your children, your parents, to do the things that are about interaction rather than production. There's no problem here. And here, let me show you how. First, give everybody a job. Second, if that produces more output that strains our natural environment or that doesn't leave us enough leisure, then here comes the punchline. Then let's cut back everybody's hours. If the issue is to be fair to everyone, then give everyone a job. If the issue is to be fair to leisure and the environment, then give everyone a job that isn't 40 hours long, but's only 35, or 30, or 28, whatever. That's the way we accomplish saving the environment and giving ourselves more leisure if we prefer those to output. Let's make that a democratic decision, not driven by the private profit calculations of capitalists, but by the desire of the entire population, democratically articulated. The way to solve the problem of too much production is not condemning some people to be unemployed while others work full-time or overtime. That's irrational. The way to deal with our environmental concerns and our concerns for leisure is to give everybody a job equally, and then let's all discuss how much we reduce the total work we all do to achieve the objectives we prefer. Finally, for today's longer conversations on more major topics, let me talk about a famous recurring problem for which we have a stunning illustration over the last couple of weeks. I'm talking about Seattle, Washington, and I'm talking about the Boeing company, the company that makes most of the aircraft, both civilian and military, in the United States. Famous corporation, the Boeing Aircraft Company, based for a long time in Seattle. Periodically, the Boeing company does something that is typical for many companies. It goes to the authorities in Seattle and in the state of Washington, and it basically says to them, we're thinking of moving. Why are we thinking of moving? Because another state, and in the case of Boeing, if I have done my research properly, it's the state of South Carolina, but it doesn't really matter, any other state, is offering us, the Boeing officials say, an opportunity to build our engines and our airplanes and so on down there, in that other state, where we can pay workers less, or where we can pay workers less and also get a holiday and not have to pay our taxes, say, for 5 or 10 years, or get the state to build a network of roads that are profitable for us to be able to use. In other words, the big corporation goes to the city it's located in, or the state it's located in, or typically both, and says, look, I know you need me to stay here. Because if I leave, there'll be thousands of people without work. You will not get the taxes anymore from me because I'll be now paying them in the state I go to rather than Washington. And after finishing this speech, which, by the way, city and state officials don't even need to hear because they've heard it all before, it becomes clear what they want. They want the state to do something for them. So, for example, Boeing demanded, and the state of Washington has provided, billions, with a B, in tax reductions for that company to keep them in the state, to prevent them from leaving. Now, of course, as with the religious exemption I just talked about, if Boeing pays less in taxes, that doesn't mean it doesn't get the same services from the state and local governments that it always did. It simply means they don't pay for them. Those state services and city services now have to be paid for by other taxpayers. That's right. If Boeing pays less, the rest of the citizens of Washington are going to have to pay more or do without the services that the state can no longer provide because Boeing is no longer required to pay the taxes it otherwise would have. There's no nice way to describe this. But Boeing went further, and again, this is typical. Boeing also turned to its workers and said, "You all are here in Washington, in Seattle. You have your families here. You have your friends here. Your kids go to school here. You are citizens here. And if we pull up and leave and resettle in the Carolinas or some other part of the United States, you'll be out of work. You'll be out of income. Your communities will be ravaged by the resulting losses. So you're not in much of a position to bargain. And here's what we want. We want you to pay more of your health care costs. We want you to accept little or no wage increases. We want to change and reduce your benefits." You get the picture. This is happening all over the United States. This is how capitalism works. Sometimes this is called a race to the bottom. Every capitalist corporation that's in a position to do so plays off the federal government against other governments, state governments against one another, city governments against one another. It's what can you do for me that's the name of the game. And I will move to whoever gives me the best deal. Why? Because then my profits go up, and in the way we run our society, I have no responsibilities for the economic devastation I leave behind. The empty factories, the job loss, the tax revenue diminishing for the local and city, state and federal governments. I don't have to worry about it. It's not my problem. I'm a private enterprise. I can cause devastation where I wish and benefits where I choose, and I choose to go where the wages are the least and the tax holidays the richest. Boeing is not unique. But interestingly, the unions, who usually have very little bargaining power, what are they going to do? They could decide to call the bluff, to say, "No, we're not giving it back because we think you're bluffing, you're not really going to move." That looks to be what happened with the Machinists Union in Seattle. By a two-thirds vote, the Machinists Union members, thousands of them, rejected the demand of Boeing. So in a sense, they've called the bluff. We'll see whether Boeing goes. But let's ask the really interesting question. Why are the companies in the driver's seats while the governmental officials and the union officials are beggars, trying to work the best in a bad situation, trying to keep the tax holiday they have to give to Boeing less than it would otherwise be, so it's not quite the burden on the people of Washington? That's what we hope the politicians are doing. And likewise, the union leaders trying to get the givebacks they have to give to the company to be smaller than they might otherwise be as the bribe to the company not to move. Is that the best government and unions can do? Are all the powerful cards really in the hands of the corporations? Well, I think not. I think if people understood how this game is played, who wins and who loses, it would be much harder for these companies to pull it off. But there's more that can be done. more that can be done by the unions and more than can be done that can be done by the government. And maybe if the unions and government acted together in a way I'm about to describe, they really could come up with a counter-strategy that the corporations would have to sit up and deal with. Here's the counter-strategy. Say to Boeing, like you say to any other company threatening to go elsewhere, go ahead, be our guest, go. But just know this, Mr. Boeing executive or Mr. Capitalist executive, whoever you are. We, the government and the union and the workers in this factory, in this office, in this store, we're going to stay here. We're going to keep working. We're going to run this business as a cooperative. The workers know how to do all the work anyway. We can hire supervisors and technicians if we need them. And the government can give us the money to help make the transition from a capitalist enterprise to an enterprise owned, operated by the workers and the larger community. And by the way, is that going to cost the government some money? Yes, but it's a lot less money than they were about to give away to the company, which got them nothing, simply that the company wouldn't leave. So the money that the government was about to give in tax cuts and tax holidays to the company, the money that was about to be lost by the union in giving up benefits for its workers, that's the money that can be used to help accomplish the transition from a capitalist, top-down, hierarchical corporation to a cooperative enterprise run together by the union and the larger community. And because that enterprise, run by the union and the larger community, wouldn't have to earn a profit because it's got no shareholders and no one to pay a profit to, if what it really has to do is produce good airplanes and create good jobs, not a profit, they'll be able very nicely to compete with the Boeing Corporation, having moved, if it dares to the Carolinas. And think of the advertising campaign. All around the country, salesmen and women will go saying, hey, you can buy an airplane from the workers and the state of Washington, which got together to keep jobs, to keep a decent lifestyle, and were not told to knuckle under by a company that wants to get away with moving somewhere so it can pay workers much less and pay taxes much less. This is not a good competitive scene for Boeing or for any other company. Setting up worker co-ops is a strategy that governments and unions can collaborate on to change the playing field in their negotiations with companies that threaten to leave. And it would make the government and the unions more powerful and more effective than going it alone, which is what they've been doing and which has not helped them very much. To be as polite about it as I know how. I turn now, as we often do at the end of our program, to use up the last 10 minutes or so of this program to respond to some of your questions. And I've picked two today because I thought they were particularly timely and particularly appropriate. The first comes from a listener in the Philippines. And I wanted to take a moment not only to thank this listener, but to make all of you aware of something we are enormously proud of here at Economic Update. Our program is live streamed on the internet. You can also listen to these programs, archived, each and every one of them, on our website, rdwolf.com. And apparently a growing number of you all around the world are either listening live stream on the internet or listening through the internet by going to the archives on our websites. In addition to thanking you for doing that and the wonderful vote of confidence you give us, I wanted everyone to know of this sort of global reach of the program. And in respect to that, I wanted to respond to this listener's view from the Philippines. And of course, as all Filipinos know, the overwhelming topic for weeks now has been the typhoon that ravaged large parts of the Philippines. And the question goes, what is the relationship between the global economy, capitalism as a system, on the one hand, and the devastation of a typhoon of the sort that has hit the Philippines and caused such death, such injury, such loss of property, and such suffering across its many islands? Well, the first answer, which the questioner pointed to, is fairly obvious and well known. There are thousands of conferences over the last 20 years, thousands of scientific reports that talk about the phenomena called global warming. Basically, the idea being that the rush to capitalist industrialization, driven above all by the profit motive of money to be made by capitalists going into production, we know that those capitalists have, in most places in the world, not been required to deal with the environmental impact of the emissions of carbon and carbon dioxide and so on into the air that their factories spew, the particulate matter, all of the pollutions and damages to the ozone layer and so on that come from modern production. They haven't been required to limit them in most cases. They haven't been required to offset them in most cases and so on. And one of the results is to change the climate of our planet. This is a serious problem. It has been looked into and found to be a serious problem by an overwhelming preponderance of scientific knowledge. More than enough that in any rational society, not that we ever know absolutely what the truth is, but as best we can tell, it would be in the interest of the health and welfare of the people of this planet to limit the global warming and the climate damage that we are doing. But the interests of the profit makers stands in the way. They don't want to be limited. They don't want their profits to be reduced by being required to limit or offset or clean or whatever their profit-making activities. There is mounting evidence that the kinds of storms represented by Hurricane Sandy in the United States and now the typhoon in the Philippines are a direct result of our failure to curb capitalism, even if only to the point of not destroying our ecosystem. So one problem of the relationship of capitalism to typhoons is the problem of cause and effect, and we ought to be doing something about the cause. But there are other dimensions. It is known that typhoons can happen. This is not a new phenomenon. It is therefore prudent in all societies subject to extreme storms at certain times of the year or under certain global conditions to take all kinds of steps to protect their people. The minute we have that kind of a mentality, the question arises, who's going to pay for the protective steps? And by protective steps, I mean ways to control flooding by controlling waterways, building houses out of stone, cement, or brick rather than the much less storm-resistant bamboo or wood or shacks made out of cardboard. So the question is immediately, who's going to pay for the life-saving protection? And that brings you right up to the question of the inequality that capitalism as a system has produced inside virtually all countries of the world, a growing, aggravated inequality in which those who have refuse to part with what they have, even when it's a matter of life or death, in protecting the mass of people from typhoons, hurricanes, tsunamis, or whatever. I think that the bottom line here is clear, that you're going to have to deal with the inequalities of our societies in order to properly manage these kinds of storms. And I want to thank the questioner for bringing that dimension to us. In the time that remains, very briefly, another criticism, that capitalism is not the root of all evil and that I am to be criticized for somehow presenting the idea that it is. I agree with that criticism. I certainly did not mean and do not mean that capitalism is the root of all evil. There is no root of all evil. For every evil that we can define in the world, there are many causes. The reason I focus on capitalism is really simple. It's because so many other commentators on the world we live in don't. Not only do they not focus on capitalism, they barely discuss it at all. And at the bottom line of that situation is, it's my job in part to compensate for the lack of understanding that many of the problems we face have one of their roots in the capitalist system. And that if we want honestly and sincerely to solve these problems, then part of the solution is to question and change, and if necessary, go beyond the capitalist system in order to produce a solution. It's not the only way to solve the problem, but it is a necessary part of solving many of our problems, as, for example, the typhoon in the Philippines. Moving to another system is something we could have and should have been talking about all along. I stress it because it has to be brought back into the conversation. Thank you very much for your attention. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. Remember, please, to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and I look forward to talking with you again next week.
Gonna be my time, baby. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.